Ben Moore has been in love with bees for as long as anyone can remember. And as far as we can tell, the feeling is entirely mutual. Although he still sometimes feels the sting of his passion. Hang around, learn a little. It's as sweet as honey and always a buzz. It's the Ultimate Pollinators Podcast with Ben, his friends and associates, and of course, Ben's bees.
Hello everyone, Bees with Ben. Got a bit of a different episode this one. This is a recording that myself, Simon Mildren from the Hive Buddies, we have Dr. Anna Karukin from Buka Warang Boutique Aperies and Honey, and myself, and Dr. Erica Shelley. Dr. Erica Shelley, she's invented this protector bee, which is an awesome contraption that goes on the front of the hive, which we're going to hear all about it. So I'm super pumped to produce and release this episode. It's really, really cool. Dr. Erica Shelley's out of Canada, and we had a real interesting time difference, but she is absolutely amazing. So really, really cool. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. What I'll do is I'll put in the show notes some links so you can actually check out the product and see the visually. So anything at all, let us know, and hopefully you enjoy this episode.
Good evening, everybody, and hello to you, Ben.
Hello, Si. How you doing? Good to see you. Oh.
Awesome to see you too, mate. It's great to be here with you tonight, and I'm looking forward to us getting on with our session this evening and having a good quality chit-chat. But while we're waiting just for a few more people to join, I know there's a few people keen to join us here tonight. I thought we'd just have a little bit of a chit-chat while we're waiting. And given we've got someone joining us from overseas, I'm pretty keen to hear about your experiences, just briefly, with what's going on overseas in beekeeping for you. No doubt you've done beekeeping in the past overseas. You've told me so. What have you done? What's your experiences there?
Good question. So I've been absolutely privileged to go to so many countries. So I think it's clocked up over 30.
Wow. When I
travel, yeah, I'm lucky. And whenever I travel, I look at where I'm going, and the next thing I research is what beekeepers I can find. And so that's the focus. So I'm really really excited for that. But it's been I've been travel. A couple of highlights was definitely Ireland. You know, the Irish bees. You know, I mean, they really feisty bees, and they work hard, and they sort of live in tough conditions. But that was definitely a highlight.
Oh, and is there anywhere that you've gone that you feel like it's beekeeping is completely backwards to what you're familiar with?
Oh yeah, definitely different was Vietnam. So I was lucky enough to go to a little village, just a little bit 2 hours north of Hanoi, and that was amazing. Wow. To see. Yeah, it was absolutely incredible, because what was amazing about them is there was actually three families on this one street, and they all worked together. They all had their own businesses, but they worked together. But they made everything from scratch. Everything.
What do you mean?
Wow. Everything. So they got like the timber, like it could be bamboo, that was used as frames for with inside the hive. It was absolutely incredible to see.
And over there, like, I've got very little context to that, and I'm sure some of the people watching might not be sure either. Are they dealing with European honeybees like we do here in Australia? What do you remember about that?
Yeah, no, certainly. So they're actually dealing. The reason why most countries are dealing with the European honeybees is because they're a good nectar, you know, forager, and a good honey producer. When looking at the little Asian honeybee, which is an awesome little bee, it's really cute and little.
Okay.
Actually, funny story about the Asian honeybee. It's hard to get them to sting you because they're so little, and so it's a bit different to the European honeybee, which will quite happily sink a stinger in you. But it was actually interesting seeing the small Asian honeybees, obviously smaller boxes, but obviously smaller amount of honey.
That's bizarre. Now, just for those people that are watching at the moment, we're just waiting for a few more people to join us, and then we'll introduce the rest of our panel for the evening. While we're waiting for that, we're just talking to Ben Moore from Ben's Bees about his experiences traveling around the globe doing his beekeeping. Now, Ben, we're a pretty lucky country here in Australia overall, but with beekeeping, nonetheless, that's super important. We're very lucky here. What can you say that we do really well in Australia, or we're very fortunate for in Australia with our beekeeping?
Okay, two parts, two answers to that question. One is we don't have that little nasty pest of Roa destructor, which I'm looking forward to talking to Erica all about that. That's one. But the other thing is we're blessed with in Australia is the amount of obviously good food stores that we have. All the eucalyptus, we've got over 700 different types of eucalyptus. So plenty of forage for them and the bees. And obviously the other thing is too, our mild conditions. Even us in Melbourne, we might silk and carry on about a cold winter. I tell you what, it ain't cold when you get to like say Canada. And once again, we're going to hear from Erica all about keeping bees in the snow.
I'm absolutely fascinated by that because you're right. We do tend to make some sort of complaint and fuss here about the cold wind that we get, but there's barely a day in any one year that we would even have snow fall, let alone snow land on our beehives. We've really got no idea, do we? Compared to, say, someone like Erica, who talking with her just a week ago, she was telling me there's 5 foot of snow sitting on the ground around her beehives at the moment. What a different perspective that is for beekeeping compared to what we're used to.
It is. And obviously, having that amount of snow, obviously, a whole heap of set of challenges. Now, what do you do with your bees over winter? Now, what do we do? So that's absolutely incredible. So I think the only thing is we suffer a bit is the heat. You know, we get those 40-degree days. But I think the bees, you know, they seem to manage pretty good when it's hot.
Do you think that the idea behind there being really cold weather can actually, or a cold winter, proper cold winter, can actually help bees in that it really does change their cycle? Whereas here in Australia, our bees will generally reproduce all year round. Whereas if you've got a really cold climate, often there is, they've got to obviously stop produce. The queen will stop laying for a period of time. What do you think that means for bees, and how does that compare to us? Have you got an idea there?
Yeah, that's good question, Si. So I think when we look at that, when we look at our winters, I've had to do the odd sneaky look. You know what I mean, just for whatever reason. You know what I mean, just to double check the bees, which is not ideal, but sometimes you got to. I've never opened up a hive in all the years I've been beekeeping in cool weather, and there's always been brood. Where overseas, you'll actually, they'll have a complete cutoff. So, which is beneficial for that little mite, Roa destructor. So for us, so we've got to watch it sometimes because the bees can build up too quick at the end of winter, start of spring, and we can have a colony collapse where they eat all their stores because we've had, you know, terrible rains or, you know, a little bit colder, extended winter, a late start to spring, so we can have that set of problems.
Have you heard about beekeepers in Australia, and I'm talking probably the commercial sort that are here for honey production or serving the pollination industry here in Australia, of them putting their bees, their entire hive, inside cold storage so that actually sort of force a break for the queen to lay eggs to give that sense that there's winter? Do you know if much of that goes on in Australia?
I've never, ever heard of anyone in Australia doing that because it'd be incredibly expensive just to, you know, build a shed. Build the shed, let alone thermostatically control it. But I think that may be a solution. Hopefully we don't, but if we do get that little horrendous little mite, that could be part of helping that, you know, break that cycle.
I do know of someone who is a commercial operator over in South Australia, and they've prepared for that with cold storage, ready to go into that for when Varroa does arrive. And that's a pretty bold thing to do. I guess it's something that we all know will happen at some point in the future. So they're making those preparations now. Just for those that are watching, we're just here between Ben and myself having a brief chat for just a couple more minutes only while we just wait for the last few people that are wishing to join. You may have noticed there's a chat box down the on one side there for you. Feel free to say hello. Nice to see you're here, Paul, all the way from Normandy in France. Two conversations in a day. That's wonderful, mate. And hopefully there's other people here willing just to let us know where they're from, and looking forward to that next part of the conversation. So, Ben, I'm guessing that there might be a few people on this chat tonight that are fairly new to bees or have no idea about bees, full stop. You and I have talked a little bit already about a pesky little mite. Do you want to give the really simple explanation of what this mite is and why you and I have been talking about it tonight?
Yes, this little mite, Varroa destructor.
just look at that name, Destructor. Obviously, it is nasty. It spreads viruses, spreads disease. Now, the easiest way to describe it, kind of think of it like a flea. But that flea is equivalent to having a basketball sucking my blood. And they do the same to, crazy, huh? And they do the same to bees, except obviously bees, they have blood. It's hemolymph. And they spread diseases, obviously get deformed wing virus and really create carnage on that colony. So that's why it's so important that we keep that varroamite out of Australia. And we've got some really cool biosecurity actions that's happening, plans through ports and Melbourne's, and that's we're really, really doing a good job.
Thanks for that explanation, Ben. Well, do you know what? I think it's time that we get the show on the road. So I'm just going to a little bit of a change of pace, and we're going to invite our guest over in just a brief moment. So thank you, everybody, for coming along and being part of tonight's session. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. My name is Simon Milgen. I'm the CEO of Hive Keepers and also one of the hosts of Hive Buddy, our online social learning platform for beekeepers. But tonight is a joint event between both Hive Buddy and the Bees with Ben podcast. And it's also an absolute thrill for me personally to be hosting our first international guest as part of this series. It's pretty awesome. So tonight you'll be hearing from Dr. Erica Shelley. She is the CEO of Best for Bees, which is a Canadian company with a strong research focus. So that's where it's come from, as a research focus, which actually happens to have led to a very useful product that has recently appeared on an Indiegogo campaign. Now, there'll be more of that soon, and you'll get to learn exactly what that's all about. But there's a lot more to Erica and her story that we're going to hear from. So we've also got two wonderful co-hosts that are going to run tonight's session. You've already seen a little bit of the very talented Ben from Bees with Ben podcast, but you're also going to have Dr. Anna Karukin, who happens to be a beekeeper, botanist, bee educator, and the list continues. And she's here to help bring that conversation together. So those three will be discussing all sorts of matters relating to keeping bees in that challenging environment of North America. I can't wait to hear a little bit about that. And obviously, we'll be also discussing the research that Erica has been a part of. And no doubt, we'll discuss the Protector Bee, which is that innovation that we've already sort of alluded to. As I've already mentioned, it'd be great for you to make a comment in the chat area to let us know where you're from tonight. It'd be great to know that. But there's also a Q&A section. Hopefully that might be showing for you on your screen. I'll check that in a moment. But please put your questions there as we go through the night, and we'll loop back to those and have the opportunity to answer as many of them as possible. So you know what? That's all from me for now. I'll be back later in the show to bring your questions to the panel, as I mentioned. But without further ado, here is your...
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. And it's great to be here with you all, whether you're new to beekeeping, yet to get bees, interested in bees, or even, working in the industry on a large scale operation. We're really glad that you could join us tonight. Thanks to Dr. Erica Shelley for joining us all the way from Canada in what's the middle of the night over there. And Ben, it's lovely to have you here as well. So I'm going to begin our what will be a really interesting conversation, just to put to words a thought that I've had in my mind since we first caught up for a chat prior to this evening, is what was your light bulb moment in beginning your journey in thinking about the concept of bee vectoring? And what led you to that point, given your background and journey with bees?
All right. Can you guys hear me okay now?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Sorry, I jumped on a little late. Sorry, I thought we were starting later, so I didn't get my coffee in me. It is 3:30-ish in the morning here now, so I'm just so happy to join you guys. And Anna. I just, to answer your question, I just, first of all, to let people know what bee vectoring is. It's a super, super simple process where a bee walks through a powder and that powder sticks to the bee, and then it either walks around or flies from flower to flower and drops off little bits of that powder wherever it visits. So it's been actually being used for probably 15 years or so for crop protection, and typically used a fungus. So the fungus, is carried by the bees. And here the fungus that we use is a natural soil fungus. So we're not bringing anything into the environment that already was not pre-existing in the environment. And this fungus is, it's what we call entomopathogenic, which means that it, entomo goes for the insect, and then it goes into the insect, and it uses both mechanical and enzymatic pressures to get into the insect. And then it just starts growing and reproducing, kind of like zombie-like, it takes over the body. And then that insect just becomes a substrate, like a something for the fungus to grow. And then the spores, keep going. And it's a really great way to protect crops from, different pests and diseases, and even other fungi, because it'll grow on that space as well. So it outcompetes other fungi. So coming up with bee vectoring was not my idea whatsoever. I will, just going to say that was pre-existing. And I happen to be a half hour from the University of Guelph. So I'm in Kitchener, which is Ontario, Canada. So I'm about an hour outside of Toronto, and then about half an hour from the University of Guelph, where Peter Kevin does research with bee vectoring. In fact, I had a meeting with him. We did a talk earlier today, and he said in the late 80s is when he came up with the idea of bee vectoring. So, wow. So not a new concept at all. And it was just that the last 2 years that we've now turned it around, and we've got the bee vectoring happening inside the hives, where bees are carrying powder into the hive to protect them against pests and diseases. So instead of having them as tools in terms of crop protection, now we're helping them with the bee vectoring.
That's awesome, Dr. Erica. That's really good to hear. That's absolutely amazing, research that's happening with this sort of vectoring. So I've got a question, because I see some cool people in the audience there, Bronwyn, Prashant, Paul, and I see Alan. Now, Alan's from Darwin. Now, I might be guessing, and we've got Robert who just joined in as well. Thank you. Now, Alan's from Darwin. So many, many people, I think it's something like the statistics in Australia, over 75% of Australians have never seen snow. Now, we're having a chat last week. I know. We haven't had a chat last week. I think you had 5 foot of snow. Tell us about that, Dr. Erica.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so first of all, I grew up in the desert. I actually grew up when I was young in the States. So I can feel the not seeing snow, except if we went up any elevation, we would see snow. So it's not like I never saw snow. So it's mind-blowing to me that, would you say 75%?
I think something like that, the statistics is massive, the amount. I've got 4 children and none of them have seen the snow.
Oh, snow is so fun, except for the shoveling and the cold. I always said if you could just have warm snow, it would be perfect, right?
Exactly.
I'm sorry. What was your question? Nobody saw snow.
And it's so funny, and it's sort of funny to see. But I suppose my question is, regards to keeping bees. I mean, it's keeping bees. How do you manage, that sort of? So, what temperature minus Celsius? What does it get down to? And how do you manage your bees?
We get pretty cold. So we'll get down to our coldest weather be like minus 20. Or a little bit more, and then you have the wind chill, right? So then, it's even colder than that. It's interesting, the bees, they the coldest winters that we've had, I've actually had the most success with my bees surviving through winter. So our winter losses are really high here. So winter here, so I have my bees ready for winter by Halloween. That's usually my, you know, they've gotta be sort of either wrapped and have guards on them and their entrances reduced and their space reduced, and we make sure they have enough honey. And you know, we're looking at, I don't know if you guys are weird like us, but we, you know, use feet and pounds, and then we use kilometers and Celsius. So, anyways, so usually like 100 pounds of honey to, you know, kind of get into winter or more. And then, yes, we've just got to make sure all of those things are in place. So we've got November, December, January, February, March, and then in April is about when we'll start seeing the bees start flying a little bit. And then May, and then all of a sudden in May, we've got to start thinking about splits. It's like, all, you know, it's like quiet splits. So there's just a huge break from beekeeping, right? It's very different, I think, when you're in warmer climates, and so the prep time is big. But the bees, they stay warm even when it's that cold out. I have a I call it a gun. It's, you know, this FLIR allows you to see the heat inside, and you can always see like where the bees are, and it's so bright, you know, the bright red. And so they, you know, they form this ball of bees when it gets cold, and then that ball expands and contracts based on the temperature outside. So most of winter here, it's quite contracted. But if we get a day that's like even around 0 degrees, but sunny, the bees will do cleansing flights because they won't poop inside the hive. So they'll do cleansing flights. So we'll see the bees coming out. You have like kamikaze bees is what I call them. They like fly out, and if they get caught in the snow, they just die, right? They look like they just, you know, suicide, took themselves out going flying. But then you also get these poop streaks all over the snow. People's cars get covered in poop. You know, like it's a poop bonanza because the weather has warmed up. And yeah, so, but that's a great sign. So if you don't see dead bees and you don't see poop after a warm day in front of your hive, then you know you've possibly lost it. And so our losses can be, you know, in North America, up to 50%. I will say, like, just the last, we had a warm day this last week, and there were beekeepers coming on saying they had lost every single hive. So, you know, you start winter as a beekeeper, and you can actually come out not a beekeeper at the end of winter. So it can be really rough, but that doesn't have to do with the cold. And we're going to talk about, I think, this a little bit more, but it's what your population of bees is going into that winter period. And this little mite, this Varroa destructor, is pretty much the predictor of how your bees are going to overwinter if they're going to make it through.
That is phenomenal, Erica, to hear that you were dealing with such cold weather and such a long cold winter that the bees are cooped up inside the hives. We really don't have a lot of comprehension about that. Our, you know, cool, mild winters are probably a bit like your spring in a way. And that's one massive thing to deal with. But you mentioned Varroa mite as one of the challenges that face Canadian beekeepers. That and what other things do you see as, you know, presenting real challenges and threats to your bee colonies and beekeeping where you are?
So Varroa mite is unfortunately the winner in terms of if you have to like measure your issues here where we are. So Varroa mites, they, if people aren't familiar with them, because they're so lucky to live in the only place on the planet that doesn't have Varroa mites. they're these little tiny red mites that feed on the bee larvae. They actually feed on the fat. And when they're feeding on the larvae, they transmit different diseases and they just weaken the colony. So the one that's super obvious in terms of diseases is deformed wing virus. So the bee is born and it's got like the exoskeleton, like the outline of where its wings would be, but they're all shriveled up. And it can't fly. And that's like, if you see that in your hive, you know you've got a varroa mite issue. And believe it or not, some people never notice the varroa mites or they don't see them. They often hang out on the underside of the bee and they're harder to see. But once you have a lot of them, like they're, you know, very obvious to see. And if you open up, particularly drone brood, they do prefer drone brood because it's in development for a longer period of time. And then they're undercover as well. So drone is preferred over the worker larvae for food source. And so it just overall will weaken the hive. And then as going into winter, it for some reason in the fall, the numbers will just explode. And so we have drug treatments. We use oxalic acid. We use formic acid. We use I'll use frames of drones. And then, you know, you basically take out this capped drone brood and you power wash it, put it in the freezer, and, you know, you can actually like trap them that way. We have to do mite checks where we take 300 bees and we put them in an alcohol wash and we shake it to count the number of mites, or we do sticky boards. Like beekeeping is very intensive with varroa mites. Like there's just, you know, monitoring them, treating them. And even this year, like everybody did all their treatments and the varroa mites have become resistant to a lot of the treatments that are already out there, or they're getting more populous. So varroa mites are number one. The second one that's actually huge in North America is another little six-legged creature, the small hive beetle. And the small hive beetle has not made it to my apiaries yet. So when I was doing our beekeeper beta studies with our product, I traveled an hour south here, and actually I'm going to grab this, but I had this bee guardian on the hives, and the idea is that the mites can't fly in directly, so it kind of tricks them, and then they fall off. So it's like an entrance reducer with this in front of it, so they would fly here, they fall off, and they can't get in. So there's all sorts of little tricks like this to deal with the small hive beetles, and they leave a mess behind. And so, like if you take off your honey supers and you don't harvest your honey right away, everything gets slimed and ruined. So, you know, you gotta take it off right away. The bees put this. Oh, you guys have small hive beetle, right? You guys. Mm. Yeah,
I'm not telling you anything. More prevalent.
Okay, I'm just like realizing. I'm like, oh yeah, you guys know about this. So they have like these little propolis gels, and the bees even herd them. Like it's and then here they're, you know, treating the ground because that's where they reproduce. So. But your listeners might actually have more experience with small hive beetle than I do. So it's a big issue here. And, one of the things we're focusing on with our research this upcoming season, but nothing that I've had personal experience with, but I'm very nervous based on what people are talking about. So, those are the bigger issues. We have American foul brood, European foul brood, Nosema, so those are kind of the pests or the diseases that we're dealing with. In terms of other pests, we have to deal with, I had like an entrance reducer on my hive, and I have skunks that come through all the time, and like they'll try to get into my hives all winter, and they've pushed two entrance reducers in, and I didn't want to disrupt my hive, so I like put a third entrance reducer on the bottom. Just because you don't want to disrupt that cluster of the bees when they're cold, right? But you wanted to protect them. And the product that I've made actually helps deal with that, but that, you know, that's just one of the things. And then in the fall here, so for us, fall is August, September. Our food resources go down. So we actually have kind of a middle season compared to some of North America. I know in some places they actually only have forage for about 2 months, and then it gets so hot that there's nothing left for bees, right? We actually have forage from spring, so from May at least, April, because trees, the maple trees and stuff, they have flowers as well. So we have April, May, June, July, August. And September, we have this plant called goldenrod that comes up, and it is everywhere. And it's
that's legendary for bee forage, isn't it?
It is, and it makes the honey smell like stinky socks, mm-hmm. and like really, really pungent. So I don't know if you guys have something similar, but it's so pungent. And so you want to get your honey pulled before then. Before the goldenrod comes in. And in fact, that can actually just be a huge food resource. But once at that point of year, when there's only goldenrod left, the wasps here get really, really bad because they're getting ready to go into winter. And so the queen has quit laying eggs. And I don't know like the wasp cycle there, but here wasps actually... And I don't even know if you guys have, like, we have wasps, yellow jackets, hornets, like all these, all in this sort of the same family. They feed on a sugar produced by the larvae in the hive, right? So they're usually fed from within the hive in terms of sweetness. But, with winter coming, the queen will actually quit laying. And so there's no food resources anymore for those wasps inside their hive. And, the protein sources, the pollen is starting to diminish. And so they start robbing our beehives. Like it's a really big issue. Now, if the hive's super strong, they often can defend themselves. But if they're not, or if it's just in a bad location, particularly urban hives, they will clear out an entire hive of babies, mm-hmm. and of food resources. And so that's actually a big issue in the fall here. So I'm trying to think. There's probably other issues too, but those are... Those are the ones that come to mind of things. Oh, if you go just a little bit north here, bears are a big issue. And so people set up their apiaries with electric fences around them. But the bears, they just come in and they just flip the whole hives, right? So that's phenomenal. A problem. And pesticides. So, you know, I've got bees that are on farmland. And I'll have pesticide poisoning. Like it's very obvious to tell when they do these little circles. Like it's just, it's not great either. So we do have to deal with pesticides here as well as a threat for our bees.
Wow, that's incredible, Dr. Erica. Like so many different things. And do you get woodpeckers as well? Do they put holes in the sides of the boxes?
No, maybe because we have lots of wood. I have lots of woodpeckers. I have huge pileated woodpeckers. I got little red-bellied woodpeckers, and they just peck wood, but not hives. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Oh, is there insects in your hives? Like, is that why they're? I mean, other than bees, are there insects in the wood?
It's actually interesting, Dr. Erica, because we actually don't have woodpeckers here that will actually put big holes in the sides of our hives. But I just recently heard that for some beekeepers, it can be an issue. In Canada and North America, they have these big sort of big holes in the side of their hives, which is a very unusual thing. So they've got to put this wire mesh, which is absolutely incredible. But it's obviously speaking about protecting hives. Now you've created, and I'm super, super excited, as we all are, to hear about this product. So please tell us all about it because I'm super excited to hear.
All right. So, we had this project, this bee vectoring project that Dr. Kevin brought my company Best for Bees on. So Best for Bees, just a little bit of background. I started beekeeping probably about 12 years ago or so with the intention of having two hives and drinking tea. and taking honey. That had been my plan. And so that obviously has gone a little bit sideways. I now have bees all over the city, and at any given time, I'm not actually sure how many hives I have, but it's a few, and more than two. So I started I'm a scientist. My background's molecular medical genetics, and so the two weren't, they were two separate things. They weren't related to one another whatsoever. And then I really got into bees and the issues that bees were having, started going to conferences. I had some amazing mentors here in North America and then farther south as well. And just really became a tiny bit obsessed with bees. And so I became kind of known as the bee lady, and then companies in town were asking me to, keep bees at their locations and educate their employees about bees. And I was like, oh yeah, I can do that. No problem. And then all of a sudden, started getting inquiries about using my science side of things to study honeybees. So I work with a lot of different companies. We work with farms, seed companies, research companies, other types of companies that need to know whether or not hives are healthy, and where bees maybe are traveling, and all sorts of metrics regarding honeybees. So I had no intention of doing bee research at the level that I'm doing it now, and certainly not as a full-blown company. But things just happened, and when the job that you could only dream of comes to you, where you get to mix your hobby with your work, you just jump right on board, and you're like, all right, let's do this. And so it was Dr. Peter Kevin at the University of Guelph who contacted me to help out with his bee vectoring research, this project he called inspincing. So the idea is bee vectoring going out to crops is outspincing, and then bee vectoring going into beehives is inspincing. And so he wanted us to do what we do, which is basically take care of the beehives, look at all of the metrics. But then he was taking advantage of the fact that I had also done fungal research as part of my microbiology side of things. So, I do PCR, I deal with bacterial plates. So this was like the most amazing intersection between what I was trained to do and beekeeping. And I honestly never, ever thought the day would come when those two things would intersect. So it was like, almost like I was born for this particular project. Like it was just meant to happen. And so he brought us on, had a prototype of something that was going to let the bees carry powder in. And it was this big, the size of a bottom board, plexiglass with little ramps. And so the idea was there's two levels. So the second level, the bees would fly out, and the bottom level, the bees would come in, they'd walk through a powder and then go up those ramps and deliver that powder throughout the hive. So we jointly wrote a grant and got 2 years of funding to do this. And that ramp idea, it was awful. So I apologize to the poor graduate student who worked on it. I don't know if they'll ever listen to any of my talks because they had done this years before, but it didn't like the bees move powder out. So they would just be like, they're like, get this powder out of here. And then they'd just be flying in and out the top and in and out the bottom. There was no rhyme or reason. And I was just like, I'm like, honestly, almost crying. My research assistants were like, what are we going to do? Like 2 years of this project with this thing. And we're coloring, little coloring papers to like give colors to try to like, persuade the bees to come in on the level that we want them to come. We've got entrance reducers stacked like Lego to try to like make them go where we want them to go. And none of it was working. It just was not working. And I was like, had a long sit down and talk with myself and said, okay, you got to come up with something else. And so, you know, in the spirit of beekeeping, and I'm guessing in Australia, it's the same, you know, community is huge. Like, I feel so lucky to be part of a hobby where people just love to talk about it all the time and support each other and come up with ideas. And so I used that community. I started, you know, going on to Facebook groups and forums and saying, hey, I've got this problem. And everybody had different ideas of different ways to do it. And none of them was quite right, right? I tried some of them, but they all kind of, you know, we started getting the idea, okay, we needed to have two separate, you know, an in and an out, like getting the bees, like really, really directing traffic. Like that was super important to direct that traffic. And we needed to make it so that they couldn't carry out the powder and that, you know, that, I mean, it was really simple things. It's not complicated, but they're bees and they're so smart and they figure their way out around everything, right? So I woke up one morning and apparently this is every entrepreneur's thing. I thought I was special, but this is not special whatsoever. So I woke up 3 a.m. and I was like, the cones, I could put the cones in alternating directions and I could have an in and an out because bees, there's these cones and I don't know if you guys use them, but we use them as bee escapes. So, and not very many people use them. They're a little bit more old timey. You put them, you know, between your brood chamber and your supers that you're going to remove. And then they can go in down towards the brood chamber overnight when it's cooler, which since you guys don't get much cooler, maybe this wouldn't work for you guys. So they'll go down to the brood chamber when it's cooler, but then they can't come back up because these cones are narrower on the end, right? So, and the cones are red and the bees don't see red. So, you know, again, it's another reason they don't head up and back up into the supers. So I was thinking if we use those same cones alternating on the front and we had two chambers, and there's more to it. We haven't shared all of our intellectual property with the world yet because we don't want people knocking it off before we at least get our first ones out to people. But we realized that if we did that, we could actually get the bees to carry in the powder. So I have it here. I know, Ben, you're doing a podcast, so I guess people won't be able to see it. So you can help describe for the people there. But this is it. So it's got this white casing. And then these drawers that pull in and out. And then if you pull it out, this one's really tight because we've actually gone to production. So these were originally 3D printed. This is 3D printed. But for our very last ones, we have to make sure that the fit's really tight because they'll slide super easy. And then we actually have these cone inserts. And the cone inserts can just be removed. So you could actually have this as an extra large landing board. And then the bees, you know, have extra area to fan if they have predators from above. It, you know, protects them. If it's windy, I don't know if you've ever seen bees trying to come in and land and they land on their landing board and then they kind of get blown over because it's windy. This also will protect them from it. But the cones can just be slid in and they can be put in either direction. So you can put it on the left side or the right side. And then the powder for the bee vectoring then just goes right into the tray here. And usually within 6 hours, the bees will have emptied out the powder in there. And we've had huge success now with this. And so we have different, I'm holding this up and trying to fit this into a very tight fit, which is a little ridiculous, but we've had huge success where we've been able to vector in antibiotics. Here we treat for American fowl brood ahead of the season when the spores are in their vegetative state with antibiotics. It's not done everywhere, but that's what we do here. We've had American fowl brood for a long time. And we really don't have any issues anymore because people are doing these prophylactic treatments. And then, so the antibiotics, we get the same amount of antibiotics into the hive as if we did a conventional treatment, which would require pulling the entire hive apart and putting the antibiotics with powdered sugar on the brood frames and doing that 3 times, 2 weeks apart in the spring when it's cold and it's raining. Not easy, but just throwing it in the front here allows the bees to just carry those powders in. And then we've also done the fungal powders, those entomopathogenic fungal powders that I was talking about before that were used for crops. We've been able to get those throughout the hive, but we don't have a fungus that will grow inside the hive. So remember I was talking about those fungi being in the soil or on crops. Those are very different temperatures and humidity conditions than you're going to find inside a hive. So this last year, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Paul Stamets over in Australia. He's this big mushroom fungus guy, and they actually feed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So they feed mushroom extracts to bees and have found that it's very good for improving bee health. But also they've been funding this research at Washington State University, where they're using the same fungus that we were going to be using, called Metrohesium. And what they did is they did directed evolution, where they just basically starved the fungus and added some stress conditions to get it to adapt to the environment. And so now they have a fungus that will attack Varroa mites and will grow inside the hive. So we have to wait for approval for that particular fungus. And then we're also developing some of our own fungi as well. But we use other powders like thymol dust, and then we actually have used our strips. So with these inserts, so holding this up, you see the cone inserts, we actually have other inserts that you can add. So we have, we went out to test with our beekeepers because that was part of our funding was for bee vectoring. We had to take this out and get our beekeepers to test it and say, oh, would you use it? Is it easy to put on and off? And when we went back to get the Protect-A-Bee, they didn't want us to take it. We only had like a certain number, right? And I was like, we don't even have the powders. Why do you want to keep this? And it was the end of that season that I was talking about when those wasps start attacking the hives, and they're like, the wasps aren't going for the bees at all. They're not able to get in there. And I was like, oh, I'm like, I didn't think about it, but wasps don't see the color red either. And they're a little bit bigger. And now we've got these smaller openings. So the bees are able to guard those smaller openings, and it's farther away from the food resources. So it was kind of a robbing screen of sorts, but not intentional. That had not been our plan. And so we had one beekeeper, he had the skunk issue I was telling you about, where, because the skunks, what they do is they, do you guys have skunks in Australia?
No,
you have skunks in Australia. That you are very lucky for too. Oh my gosh, you might have like the most poisonous critters on the planet, but skunks like smell up the entire area for weeks on end. My dog has gotten sprayed by a skunk so many times and it's nasty and awful. So what they do is they tap on the landing board of the hive, and then the bees come out to inquire, and then the skunk eats them. But with the Protect-A-Bee on the front, the skunks apparently weren't doing that either, so that the skunk issues weren't there. So that was pretty cool. And then as we said, so I don't know if your bees highly propolized thing, but dealing with our entrance reducers can be a huge pain. They warp because the moisture warps the wood, but as well they get propolized, so you have to like really crank, call on the hives to, get the entrance reducer out. And if you've got a lot of honey in there, that sometimes can be a little bit harder to leverage that with your hive tool. So we actually, the beekeepers asked us, they're like, oh, can you do entrance reducers? So yeah. So now we have a small and a medium one that's, basically the same size as the entrance reducers. And I use these this winter. And the neat thing is on a semi-warm day, the bees will bring the dead bees into the drawers and like in preparation for a warm day. So I could pull out my one drawer, which had a solid. So I have a solid on one side and then an entrance reducer on the other. And I could pull open that solid side and see that my bees were still alive. There's no bees in there, but there's a bunch of dead bees. So they've done all the little piling work inside the hive. And then I could dump them out. And then, you know, a few days later, see it. And of course, doing everything very, very much so that I won't disrupt that cluster, because if we disrupt that cluster, we can kill the bees, right? So we have to be very careful anytime we're, you know, looking at the hives in the winter. So yeah. And then I started, we did pollen patties. We did more solid stuff behind that solid board, because now we just basically had I call it a cartridge where, you know, you just pull it out and you can put whatever you want in there without, again, opening the hive. So it was really great for just another delivery system. And eventually we'll have a full out feeding system that we'll be able to feed through there as well. So we're working on developing that. And then, as I was mentioning, the pesticides, when my adjacent farms spray, they usually tell me they're going to spray. And so I can put the solid entrances on to keep the bees from foraging. There's usually a certain amount of breakdown time. They'll usually spray at night because it's not windy. So then I can put these on and then just keep the bees in. And then they're not exposed. And that's usually during cooler weather. If it was hot out, you wouldn't want to close your bees in because they would overheat and die. So I would not recommend for anyone listening, if you don't know, don't usually close your bees in because they'll overheat and die. Probably much more so in Australia than here in Canada. So, but we're working on doing a swarm prevention, basically a queen excluder size at the front. And that would just be for short term, like you can't get to your bees to do your splits before they swarm, or you maybe, you know, you don't have sometimes, I don't know, I'm always running out of equipment. So I don't have any bottom boards. I got to get to the store and get a bottom board before I do my next split. And so that swarm preventer, you know, just keep them for a day or two in there, till I can get everything up and going. So we have all these sort of, you know, we call it a plug and play system that we'll be able to just add these inserts and do all sorts of different things over time. And I'm really interested in seeing sort of what the do-it-yourself community does. You know, as soon as you have one thing, everybody has like 1,000 ideas. So I'm just really excited. Beekeepers especially, they're a creative bunch. So I'm just super excited to see what other inserts are coming that I never even considered.
That is such an awesome toolbox of fittings that you can put to your protector bee invention. And watching you show us all of the different entrance closures and in ramps and out ramps and all the applications that it can be used for. Do you see this being applicable to be used by people who have a hive or two in their backyard, right through to commercial beekeepers with, you know, tens, hundreds or thousands of hives?
Well, so when we started doing this, we always had in mind this would be across the board for beekeepers using. We were going. I mean, the bee vectoring was for this fungus to be used for treating varroa mites and for other stuff. So we always imagined it being used across the board by all beekeepers, but we recognized that, you know, we, you know, a beekeeper, a commercial beekeeper is not going to spend a ton of money. First of all, commercial beekeepers don't have a ton of money, right? Like it's expensive. And every time you have to do something for your hives, I don't know what your commercial beekeeping operations are like there, but here our commercial beekeepers have, you know, 1,000 hives. So if you get a new product, you've got to buy 1,000 of that product. Mm-hmm. You've got to be pretty committed that this thing is going to work for you, because you're not rolling in the dough usually if you're a beekeeper, even a commercial beekeeper. And maybe you guys, your beekeepers do better there because you have, like, you know, specialty honeys or whatever. But here our beekeepers are not rich people. They're doing this job because they love it. And you know, it's a good thing to be doing too. So So then when we came out with it, we just kind of imagined, you know, hobby beekeepers and that we could help them figure out how to keep their bees healthy. We call people who get into hobby beekeeping and just throw bees in their backyard and don't do much with them, we call them bee havers. So our goal was to take those bee havers and turn them into beekeepers, because bee havers are like the most dangerous things for bees, because, you know, the bees get sick, or in our case, they get those varroa mites, and they cause what we call mite bombs, where those varroa mite hives start robbing a hive that doesn't have varroa mites, and then now it's got varroa mites. And so, you know, they can be really dangerous for other hives, but also the flowers they're visiting and the native pollinators, and spreading diseases to those native the native bees as well. So our goal, we were thinking, was we would do hobby beekeepers, and we'd have an online mentorship program, and we'd provide everything they need to keep their bees healthy. That was our original sort of thinking once we had this protected bee. But when we did our beekeeper studies, we did commercial beekeepers as well. That was part of it. And they started talking about the time savings of just adding all their treatments. They were like, we could come in at night and do all of our treatments at night. Like, it, you know, because they're in so many different places, they run out of daylight. And, or if it was raining, and the amount of time savings they were able to translate into dollars saved, towards their beekeeping operations. So once we have proof of concept for people using it, so we have a lot of commercial beekeepers who are buying our 8-packs or our 2-packs, and they're going to test them this year. And then, you know, my expectation is then we're going to see, you know, these mass orders coming in. And we're hoping, because we're brand new, we're having to do tooling, and smaller orders means you have to pay more per product. We're hoping once we do start getting into commercial beekeepers, and we're making a lot more, we're able to make a lot more, we can bring that price down and then pass that savings on to the beekeepers, hobbyists and commercial beekeepers, like everybody. That's our long-term goal. So hobby beekeepers right now, I think, are going to probably be more likely to buy our product, just because buying two for their two hives is not that expensive. But our commercial beekeepers, or what we call sideliners here, they're you know, probably going to be a little bit slower for the uptake, but the long-term plan is that bee vectoring will probably be, it will probably replace a lot of different things that people are doing. And our entrance system just also makes it really easy as well.
That's super exciting, Dr. Erica. It's really, really cool. So for those who want to sort of jump on board and, you know, buy it, you've got actually listed on a crowdfunding campaign, Indiegogo. So tell us about that, you know, for what your goals were, because I know you've absolutely smashed out of the ballpark. So you're doing so well. So tell us about purchasing it and when it'll be available to the general public.
So thanks so much, Ben. Yeah, we decided to do a crowdfunding campaign for this. Was because I think in Australia, you guys might have heard there was this hive that came out that you could get honey from just like turning a little crank. Have you guys heard about this flow hive thing in Australia? You guys have heard about that, right?
Invented in Australia.
Oh, yes. I remember. Yes. So anyways, the flow hive was the largest crowdfunding campaign ever on Indiegogo. And so we knew that platform would possibly be a great platform for us to use as well, because beekeepers, particularly flow hive beekeepers, were already on there. And we had something magic happen. So we got really, really lucky. We got our flow hive in to make sure that ours would fit it. And so for the 7-frame flow hive, and I should mention this, we talked about this earlier with our smaller group when we met last week. Our protected bee right now, like if it's a 10-frame Langstroth hive or a 7-frame flow hive, And then we're, you know, as we've mentioned, we're trying to, we will do an 8-frame one later on as well, which would fit then the 6-frame flow hive too. So, anyway, so it fit perfectly on there, like perfectly. We like, honestly, I did a little dance around my living room. I was just like, yes, this couldn't be any better. This is great. Like just perfect. And I know that some of the flow hives didn't even come with entrance reducers in the beginning, right? So this is like a little, you know, a way to put an entrance reducer on there and little extras to it. So that's why we went to Indiegogo is because we were able to have a big advertising campaign for a purpose. And whether or not people buy our product, they're going to know about the protective bee. That was the biggie, right? Is that everybody had heard about bee vectoring and everybody had heard about the protective bee. And so we went on there and in 7 hours, so we had our goal. Oh, geez. See, I think our Canadian dollar is probably closer to yours. Our original goal was 22,000 Canadian dollars. And that was to pay for our tooling. So that just pays for the injection molding tooling. So that's like a tool that clamps and gets filled up with the plastic. And the plastic is bee-friendly, UV resistant, weather resistant plastic. And so that paid for that. So in 7 hours, we had 300 backers. Like people were on it. They wanted this. It was just fantastic. And of course your dream in a crowdfunding campaign when you're funded in 7 hours. So we've kept going. So we're now at $53,974. I'm looking at it right now with 461 backers. And so there's options to support a research hive. We have, you can get a digital subscription for people in Australia to Bee Culture magazine, which is very North American based. I think, Dr. Anna, you have a magazine there that maybe I should be adding on for our Australian people.
Possibly you could.
So we have that going, and we have 9 days left. So we're almost to the last week of running this campaign. And then our goal is to have our protective bee to people by June. So it's a pretty quick turnaround time, and we're sucking up the shipping fees. I don't know if you guys use that word, sucking up. Sorry. I mean, what it means is basically we were going to pay for cargo shipping. And now because our cargo shipping's at least 2 months out from when you actually get the product made, it's just crazy. It has to do with the cargo containers are just gone, right? So there's just this shortage of cargo containers. We're actually going to do air flight to get it to where it needs to go. And so that's a lot quicker. And just so people can have it in North America for this year's beekeeping season. So we just want to make sure it's in people's hands and they get a full year. And a full year is going to be different everywhere they are in North America. But, you know, more of a year with the protective bee. So that, you know, next year as we roll out these powders and we're going to have a subscription service so that they can get everything they need to keep their hives healthy, that they've already got it and they're used to it. They're loving it, right? They're going to love it and just be like, you know, ready to tell all their friends about it. So that's on Indiegogo. If you look it up, it's Protect-A-Bee all-in-one adjustable hive entrance. And I see that there's a link in the chat as well. And even if you don't want the Protect-A-Bee, but you know, maybe you've got an 8-frame and you're not quite ready to buy this one because it won't fit. You can donate to us as well. You can sponsor a research hive. And then we'll have a e-commerce, a Shopify site coming up in the next few months as well, where we'll have pre-orders on there for the A-frame one. So once we get enough pre-orders for that, then we'll get the tooling made for those A-frame hives. And And yeah, so it's not like after the Indiegogo, you won't ever be able to get the Protectibee. But we do offer special pricing. We have VIP pricing. And in fact, what I can do for your listeners is I'll put a secret perk on there. So we'll give it to you guys a little bit cheaper. And I know because that Australian dollar, it's just like the Canadian dollar. Every time we see anything in US dollars, it's like, no. and yeah, so that'll be up there for 9 more days.
That's so exciting, Erica. And I think if my bees were sitting here watching this and listening to you talk about Protectibee, they'd be saying, Anna, we want one. Tell us more. I just keep thinking of ways to use it and you know unique situations in Australia that it could be applicable to, and just so many questions. We're getting a few questions popping up on the chat as well as we're talking, and I'm just wondering, Ben, should we open the floor to some questioning?
What an awesome idea, Dr. Anna. That'd be really cool just to see what everyone thinks, because we've got a really mixed bag here. I could see Paul's from France. We've got someone from Darwin. We've got people all over. We've got Bronwyn from the Yarra Valley. So it's going to be super exciting to see. Got some questions. See what people think.
I've come back in here, guys. I'm going to help you with those questions. And they've come through, and there's some really interesting ones. So there's still a chance for people that are watching to put some questions there, but I'll just focus our attention on a few of those. Now, it's particularly interesting, in my opinion, some of these. So, Erica, a great question's come up about your situation there in North America in the snow. How do beekeepers manage the snow across the front of their hives? Paul's specific question is, do the cones get blocked by the snow?
So what we have done, so we're just in our first year of testing even the cones with the snow. So in our first year, we were just doing bee vectoring. And so you actually only needed the cones on for 6 hours. And so it had not been our intention to overwinter hives with even this device on the front of a hive. Like, that had not been our original intention. So we're just now in our first winter of testing. But what we did is we actually changed the majority of them to the entrance reducer. So it's just our typical entrance reducer. We didn't leave the cones on, but I did leave the cones on a couple just for experimental sake. And so whether it's our entrance reducer or the cones, when we get a big snow, the hives are covered. So I think I shared with you, I don't know if you have a picture of my hives with snow there that you could maybe share with the group.
And I'll have to get back to you on that one. Not just ready at the moment, no.
Okay, yeah. So like sometimes the snow is up to like my second super, right? Like, or my first and up to the super. And so if it's out in my research apiary, which is in the middle of a farm, I don't do anything with those hives because like I can't actually get out to them. So the snow acts as an insulator. And then the bees will actually, we keep an upper entrance as well through winter here so that they can actually get out. So even if things are blocked on the bottom, we always have an upper entrance so the bees can go ahead and do that flight. So we did have like this year, I have some hives in my backyard as well. And there was definitely snow in the cones to start, but it's warm. So they actually melted these like little pathways. You could see the heat coming, right? And there was actually melting. And same around our entrance reducers, there's always some melting of the snow. So just the warmth of the heat, the hive coming out actually ends up, you know, melting things off. So they do get covered for sure. And so we've actually had to make some modifications after our testing this winter to minimize the snow melting going in, because we didn't think about the snow going on top of the device and sitting on top of the device and then melting closer to the entrance because it was warmer And then out, because we had everything sloped and going away. So now we have like just a small modification to make sure that any wetness is now not going into the hive whatsoever. And you know, we're still, you know, this is a product that is still in development, and we only see it getting better and better and better. But there's learning still to be done about, you know, especially like it was not we didn't anticipate leaving on during snow. So, you know, just things like that, that we're trying to figure out. But we did have like the wettest season on record on our second year of doing our bee vectoring testing. And we didn't get any water into the hive. Like we had rain coming sideways, and the cones actually, I think, helped that. But we would get a little bit of wet powder because the bees would be wet when they would be coming back in. So we add rice as a desiccant to the powder, and that keeps it dry. So, it was really useful. We had the hottest summer on record. We had the wettest summer on record. So, you know, it was a good learning experience, a pain when you're raining all the time and you're trying to, you know, do conventional treatments, but really lots of learning that's happening.
So you've touched on a point there, which I think is interesting. You're obviously learning a lot as this has unfolded. Are there any other limitations that you've found so far that you think you might still need to address or look into trying to solve?
So one of the things that the biggest question that we get is, because people want to leave these cones on all the time, is the ventilation issue. Are the bees cool enough in the hive? And like I said, when we originally first put the cones on there, we had planned on them being on there for 6 hours, and we didn't think about ventilation being an issue. So as we as the season went on, and actually in the first year we started doing it just because we really wanted to see what the bees would do with the cones, if they get better and faster, so we would leave the cones on all the time. We actually found that the bees were bearding less on the hives with the protective bee than our control hives. And we do these studies where we actually have software that allows us to look at, you know, the population of the hive. And so we know that the hives were equalized in terms of the number of bees, but we weren't seeing the bearding. Honey rate curing times were the same. We didn't have any mold issues. So we're like, why are they not bearding? Like, what's going on? And all we can think of is there's like, you know, that cross breeze effect when you open one window and then another, that maybe because we've got two halves that somehow the air is circulating in there. So I have a clear protective bee coming in. And we're going to see if the bees are actually fanning in there. Like, we don't know what's happening in there. It's like, you know, the black box. Once they're in there, we don't know what's happening. So we want to see what's happening in there. And then just, you know, for places that are hot, we don't know that you can leave the cones on all the time. And so what we're really telling people to do at this point is, you know, if you've got robbing issues, they don't tend to be all year long, right? Like, at least for us, it's very seasonal, that they tend to get worse when there's a dearth or, you know, not as much forage available. But if people are planning on leaving them all the time, then we'll just need to, you know, look more into that ventilation issue, possibly making more openings. We have in our patent, we have one that's got 16 openings that it's going on the front. So, you know, there's possibilities that, you know, we might, you know, maximize traffic even more and make it bigger, and it'll look pretty crazy by then, but, you know, maybe it'll be the norm.
Let me ask, let me ask Anna and Ben here, who are two experienced beekeepers in Australia. You both would have bees in very hot environments from time to time. How might, like, just some feedback for Erica, how might we overcome that issue here in Australia if we want to reduce our entrance, which was essentially what we're doing here if there's cones? How might we handle that here, or what do you think the impact might be on the bees?
It depends to some extent on what kind of hive setup you have. If you're running a traditional Langstroth hive system, whether you're using components such as vented bases or not, whether your hive is constructed of traditional timber or injection molded plastic or polystyrene hives as well, which insulate differently to the wood and the plastic. So it would be, I'm really intrigued to be able to look in the field at the effect of the cone entrances in high summer here, where you can have either hot and dry with really low humidity. It might be 40 degrees Celsius, but, you know, 4% humidity in some climatic zones. And then as you get up into the tropics in far northern Australia, you know, let's say around Brisbane in Queensland, it might only get to 33, 35 degrees, but it'll be 90% humidity. And so the evaporative cooling mechanism of the beehive is going to be less effective, possibly more bearding. But then if you have these air currents circulating in a different way to the traditional hive model, if that has an effect.
Do you have a thought on that one, Ben, or are you sort of in agreement there with Anna at this stage?
Yes, no, I agree with Anna. And just like to say to Dr. Erica, it is absolutely awesome product. So thank you so much for spending so much time to actually help the bees. But I should, I think, you know, when the bees are bearding, we get that hot, crazy weather. I know with some of my hives, you know, it's a 40-degree day. I think they'll beard, but they'll beard above the protector bee. So they'll, you know what I mean? So they'll be outside of it. So I don't think there's going to be sort of any impact with the bees as such.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, there's some thoughts and ideas from nice, hot and dry Australia, Erica. Mate, I'm looking forward to some of these guys putting it to the test. Now, I've got a question for you from Bronwyn. She's asked about, you've been able to put pollen patties in the closed section at the front. What about dry pollen and other products? I think I know the answer here, but it's probably pretty versatile.
Oh, yeah, you can, whatever you want to put in there, you can put in there. Like, in general, bees, you know, for pollen, if there's a pollen resource outside, they're going to prefer to go get pollen outside. So even if you put pollen inside, the other bees that are foraging for pollen can't actually do a dance to the drawer. Right? Like it's too short of a distance. So, you know, setting up a feed, you know, that's sometimes outside can be a little bit easier for them to get access to. But if there's conditions where they can't get outside, or maybe you have issues with things getting into your pollen outside, you know, using that drawer can work. But, you know, with pollen, you also, we don't usually feed just straight up pollen to bees, right? Because it's not really something they can easily take in once it's desiccated, right? It's not the pollen that they would normally store. But we're actually this week we're making sugar, solid sugar. We got to come up with a name for them, but basically sugar blocks that the bees will be able to eat as a I don't know if you guys do this, but we'll feed sugar to bees to, you know, get them over the hump if they've run out of honey and so forth. So we're actually doing that as well. And there is a possibility for, outspensing for things as well. But we really haven't gotten to testing that, but there is definitely some options for getting bees to take things out of the hive as well. So, yeah.
On that particular one, Anna and Ben, you might know more about the horticulture and the agriculture industries and the like here in Australia. Have you come across that before, the idea of bees taking the vector, is that the right terminology? Taking the product out to the actual plants to essentially inoculate or have some form of treatment out there into the environment. Is that something we do here yet that you've come across?
I haven't come across it in my Australian beekeeping experience, no.
It's interesting because above the roof where I am now, I actually have a device. So that Intimo vectoring device is above my roof. To be honest, I have never used it. And it's actually getting cobwebs, but I'm yet to get around to using it because there's two types of the cherries as well as strawberries here. They get obviously brown rot. And to actually get the product, which is produced in Tasmania, you can actually get it and use it as part of, as far as Intimo vectoring. So, and I've been meaning to do it. I've had it up there above this ceiling for about close to 5 years now. And I just one of those things that I need to get it, need to use it, but I just haven't had time. I know that's a poor excuse, Dr. Erica, so don't throw rocks at me, but it's there.
Well, and you know what? I wouldn't even know that you guys would have issues there with your products that you could use the bee vectoring devices. Yes, yeah, so Intimo vectoring, Apa vectoring, and bee vectoring are all synonymous. These are the words we used to call it Intimo vectoring, but that referred to any insect carrying stuff. So then Apa vectoring was referring to bees, and then that apparently is confusing. So we've now just gone straight to bee vectoring. But what I'll say is using bee vectoring out to crops, this actually is a whole new job for beekeepers, right? It gives, like, you can offer up services to farmers and that, you know, it's, you know, another thing if people are in beekeeping and they're looking for ways of making a living, you know, that's something else you can actually do as a beekeeper, is offering up those kinds of services. And Ben will be giving you one-on-one lessons on how to do the Intimo vectoring when you decide to get into it.
That's funny. Well, I decided 5 years ago, but I haven't had time to do it. I know it's a terrible excuse, but you know, as soon as it comes springtime and it's all happening, and you know what it's like, everyone that's sort of keeping bees, it's just full on, and then all of a sudden it's winter and then I get bored. I think then
you just haven't found the right moment yet, Ben. That's all.
That's right, Dr. Anna. I know. I've got to do
waiting
that.
For the exactly. Right moment.
Now I think I've got Dr. Erica here to kick me in the bum here and use it, because not many people use it. Yeah, not many in Australia. I heard there was a bit of research in Tassie on the brown rotten cherries, but yeah, not too many people use it.
Possibly more interest in horticultural crops and treatments than in broadacre.
It sounds like the sort of thing as well that might need some consideration ahead of us needing to use it, because I can imagine it's the sort of thing which may come, knowing that we can be pretty conservative in our thinking sometimes. It might come with some concerns for some people. What damage is it doing to off-target species? Is it going somewhere that it shouldn't in the environment? But it's these conversations that are probably important to begin now, and I'm sure it's happening somewhere, to make sure that when we find a proper use for it, we're ready to go and we can get to work. Well, there's two really cool questions just to finish with, Erica, and then I'm sure that Anna and Ben might have some final comments to go with as well before we wrap everything up. But these two questions here, let's start with this one. Do you have any advice to beekeepers that are from a country free of varroa? You've got the Australians here in front of you. We don't have varroa yet. What's your advice to us?
My advice is whatever you possibly can do to keep varroa mites out of your country, do that. I know Simon was telling me that there's these monitoring hives set up around the ports. But if you ever notice anything that possibly could be a varroa mite, just make sure you report it right away and deal with it right in the beginning. Like that would be the biggest thing. I mean, it is such a gift that you don't have it, and that given that it's worldwide, like, it's amazing it hasn't made it there yet. And then obviously if you guys get varroa mites, you need to contact me and I will help you get through that awful, awful time. But yeah, it's one of those things that you know, you just want to make sure that it never gets there. But in terms of other beekeeping stuff, you know, it's one of those things that sometimes, especially with hobby beekeepers, they get afraid of the bees. They run out of time, and they're not doing the things they need to do to keep their bees healthy. So if you're considering beekeeping or expanding your apiary, just make sure that you have the time, because this is, bees are an agricultural crop, right? They're an animal, right? It's not something that you can just have and then just be like, oh, they're going to be fine. They're natural and everything. No, they're not. They're being put into systems that maybe, and then of course there's other bees around and climate change and pests and diseases. So it's something that as beekeepers, we have a responsibility to other Yes. pollinators and to other beekeepers to make sure our hives are healthy. So, you know, to make sure we take that responsibility seriously, because it's very important.
And I'm sure, Ben and Anna, that hits home with you guys a lot. You'd be at the face of many, in the face of many beekeepers who you see this is not how it's done. So that's a really important message to hear from you, Erica. Last question. Is there a technology or innovation or maybe some research that you would love to work on next? Something that you think, oh, I just need to be picked for that.
Well, okay, so this bee vectoring stuff is really cool. It's going to be hard to top fungi. And I've always been a huge proponent of natural. I mean, a lot of us go into beekeeping. None of us are like, oh, yeah, I want to use every chemical on the planet in my honey, right? So I've always been a proponent of natural things to keep bees healthy. So the fungal research is the thing that really, really resonates with me that I'm really excited about. But I also came into this looking at the gut flora of bees, and I'm interested in actually looking at ways that we could even use bee vectoring to change to recolonize the gut flora so that it mimics more what originally these bees would have had before being exposed to all these different environments, to see if we can get healthier bees. So that's another thing that I'm interested in. Yeah.
Wow. there's so much going on. Oh, I can imagine how your brain's ticking over there, Anna, having had many conversations with you, what you're thinking. In saying that, Anna, was there anything that you wanted to finish on tonight or any final questions you had for Erica?
Oh, I wanted to say a big thank you for getting up in the middle of the night in Canada to come and talk to us and our audience here. It's been so informative and educational, and I've got probably a million questions that I need to, you know, keep chatting to you about. But probably before we go is just to remind people of where they can look further or delve, you know, take a deeper dive and look at some pictures and videos of the protector bee.
Yeah, so obviously our Indiegogo campaign, it will be on there for 9 days, but we also have a Facebook page. I don't know if Australians do Facebook as much as so we have a Facebook page with like over 11,000 followers, which you know, is I try to put things on there with, and I've been building that up for years. So you can like look back about, I really do focus on the science side of things and the biology of bees and the importance of pollinators. That's always been my focus. So it's a little less beekeeping, but we will be transitioning over to more beekeeping as we've come out with this device. But so that I have that page. I have an Instagram page that is not anywhere near as in depth as Ben's there. so I'm kind of building that out, so you can follow us on Instagram, and I have a Twitter account that's got 2 posts on it so far, so I'll also be adding some stuff to that as well, so they can follow us there. And then our website, bestforbees.com, that's going to be the go-to place from here on out if you want to, after we're done with this campaign, if you want to buy it or reserve it and see the powders that are coming out and accessories. So we, one of the fun things about being a maker in the space of beekeeping is that And I don't know if this happens in any industry, any other industry. So Simon also, you know, he's with his company he's a maker where he's been a creator. Is all these creators are reaching out to me and they're sending me their products and they have ideas. Like, it's just so collaborative and it's so incredible. And so I'm going to, on our site, we'll probably start having some of the things from those other creators as well, so that we can support amazing innovation in beekeeping, because at least here in the States, and I say here in the States because we in Canada get a lot of our stuff from the States, we basically have like two beekeeping supply companies, and what they decide is going to be in the beekeeping world is what's there. So it'll be really nice to be that place where if you're looking for innovation in beekeeping, Best for Bees is the place to go.
How's that? Hey, Ben, what about you? Have you got a last finishing parting comment or question that you have for Erica?
Yes, I certainly do. I just want to say thank you so much, Dr. Erica. That was an awesome presentation. Thank you so much for your time and all the research that you do. And don't forget, if you ever want to get out shoveling at snow during winter, come down to the Southern Hemisphere down here, get a summer sun, and come and check out some hives that don't have roa.
I'm on my way. I'm packing my bags right now.
Well, what a thrill it's been tonight, Erica. You've obviously heard how excited we all are to have you here. So thank you once again for making the unbelievable sacrifice to get up in the middle of your night. And we're really privileged to have you here. We wish you all the best of success with your product and your further research, which is really exciting. And I know now from our interactions and hopefully the interactions of many other Australian beekeepers that you'll have a following down under here that that comes with you and supports you in what you do. So once again, thank you. And to Anna and to Ben, as always, it's a pleasure working with you and thanks for being here tonight. And thanks to those that are there watching what we're doing and being part of the show. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
And have a good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
How awesome was that episode? Really cool to hear Dr. Erica and all of obviously what she's doing with this sort of bee vectoring or entomovectoring, or we have to call it down here in Australia. All about that. Absolutely amazing. But how full on is that? The poor bees get smashed over there. You know, just the snow, 5 foot of snow, minus 20 degrees Celsius. Wow, that is crazy. Absolutely crazy. And they get obviously all sorts of problems. So that was really, really cool to see. And don't forget, I'll put in the show notes some of those links. So really cool. Thank you, Simon from Hive Buddies for putting that up. And Dr. Anna, that was absolutely great to talk to you as well. So really, really cool. We're going to have Dr. Anna on a podcast coming up some stage relatively soon. We're going to talk about all about what she does. And she's an absolute guru. She's on botany and all things bees, so really excited. And she's actually the editor for the Australian Beekeeping Journal, so which will be awesome. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, if you want to hear someone, let me know. Shoot me through a text message, 0437-07792. Or how can I make it better? I know sometimes the audio is not the best, but, you know, how can I make it better? This is for you, the listener. So I really appreciate it. I appreciate the comments, the people calling me up saying, oh, that episode was great, you know, that type of thing. So trying to make it for you guys. So once again, thank you so much. Bye for now. Until next time, make sure you look after yourselves, look after each other, and don't forget, look after those bees.